You're listening to Radio Influence.
He got him in the white trunks. He heard him.
Beautiful.
Oh, God.
That's beautiful. He's got it.
And he forced the count. Whoa. You think it's a midget? And it's all over. It's all over. First round knockout.
Big
he's out. Rich Franklin retains his belt.
The one thing that I never thought in a million years would happen happened.
The champion. The challenger. Here we go.
This is the MMA Report with Jason Floyd on Radio Influence.
Welcome to the June 13th episode of the MMA Report podcast right here on RadioInfluence.com. Of course, I am Jason Floyd. As always, I am joined by Daniel Galvan. Come up here on this week's edition of the podcast. We are going to recap what happened last Saturday night in Chicago at UFC 225. Then we're going to recap what happened last Thursday night at PFL 1. Then I'm going to have two interviews for you. You're going to hear from Alima McFarlane, who's going to be defending the Bellator flyweight title at the end of the month at Bellator 201, the main event of that fight card. Plus, we'll talk to Jeremy Davis, who's going to be fighting this Saturday night here in my hometown, here in the Tampa Bay region in Largo, Florida. Going to be headlining the Battleground show against Carlos Espinosa. So we'll talk to both those fighters about their upcoming matchups. Then we'll have our weekly buy-sell segment, which we are going to talk about Greg Hardy. Of course, by now, you know that he did win on Tuesday night in 57 seconds against Austin Lane. Then we'll talk about some of the regional MMA going on this weekend as well. But Daniel, how you doing, man?
You know, Jason, I'm not doing too good as we talk here. I'm glad we can do the podcast because it's just been one of those weeks, Jason, where I wake up to start the day and thinking, you know what, I'm going to eat right, I'm going to exercise, and then by about 4:30, I've already had two meals at McDonald's, some buffalo wings, a Coke, and some ice cream, and I feel like crap. And that's been the past 7 days, Jason. So I'm enjoying summer, but as we speak now, I'm glad we're doing the podcast so I have an hour where I'm just not eating food.
Yeah, and just to kind of tell you exactly when we're recording this podcast, we're recording it literally just a couple of minutes after Greg Hardy's victory. And as I tweeted a second ago, you know, we as a recording, we don't know who got the contracts yet. Pretty sure we can say that Greg Hardy's going to be in the UFC, and going to be really interesting to kind of see how that plays out. But we'll talk about Greg Hardy here in a little bit. But last Saturday night, it was UFC 225. And, you know, for the second straight fight, well, Romero has missed weight for a UFC title fight. You know, a great fight. At the end of the day, you know, if you sat there and paid $65 for this pay-per-view, or if you were in attendance on Saturday night, I don't know how you can really complain about the money you spent to watch this fight card.
Exactly. I mean, you definitely got your money's worth when it comes to time. That was the one downside, is that it was a very, very, very long night of fights. I mean, this must have been 6 hours, maybe a little longer, of UFC content. So because of the decisions, it was quite a bit of content, but man, it really was enjoyable top to bottom, and we knew it heading in because so many of these fights just mattered. And regardless of how entertaining they were or weren't, just seeing the result was important, but there was plenty of entertainment top to bottom. In particular, a great main event. Obviously, you can't go with Romero Whitaker 3 because the dude just doesn't make weight, but at some point we will get that fight for sure, and I'm very much looking forward to it. It was a really great contest, Jason, and after the fight, we kind of exchanged scorecards, and I believe you told me you had scored it a draw. Is that correct?
Correct.
You went 1-2-4 Whitaker, and then I think you said 3-5 with the 10-8 for Romero, right?
Correct.
Yeah, and I totally see that, and I when I responded to you, I went 1-2 for Whitaker, 3-5 for Romero, 10-9s in the last three. And upon reflection, I totally agree with you. I rewatched the fight and rescoring it, I thought Whitaker won that fourth round. I may have overestimated kind of some of the shots that Romero landed. He was pretty gassed there, despite having that big fifth round. And I kind of agree that you obviously could make a real case that having rocked Whitaker in that fifth round, that's a 10-8.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how you don't score the final round, a 10-8 round. Round three, round of the year. I think by when we get to the end of this year and we're talking about best fights of 2018, this fight is going to be up there. It's also crazy after the fact. You learn Robert Whittaker, you know, breaking that right hand, which I forget what round it was. I looked at my buddies as I was watching a fight, and I go, something's not right with that right hand because he's not throwing it, you know, and that's usually the sign. And we saw what happened in the first fight with Robert Whittaker, weather and adversity. And to me, you can't give Yoel Romero, you know, an immediate trilogy matchup against Robert Whittaker. Just the fact of there's got to be some penalty for him for now missing weight for back-to-back title fights. I mean, look, whatever really happened there with the commission, it is what it is. And of course, Dana White, it's amazing. You know, one guy out of 26 fighters on the card misses weight, and he wants to, essentially, you knew he was going to use as, because he wants to get, away from the early weigh-ins, which Dana White saying that the majority of UFC fighters want the afternoon weigh-ins. Dana, so you're saying over 300 fighters you've talked to want afternoon weigh-ins? Based on social media, I don't think that's the case, Dana.
Yeah, I think we can literally count the amount of guys that have complained, the men and women that have complained about Dana threatening to put the early weigh-ins on the chopping block, and we could find the majority there that are against Dana. And even if you're on Dana's side, it's like Dana White is totally ruining the debate for you if you are for cutting the early weigh-ins, just because this guy, man, he did not pass debate class. I mean, he's not very good at debating things. It's so emotionally fueled and it's so illogical, and to make a decision or to make a proclamation based on one specific example when we have a fight card every single week with 12 to 14 fights on each fight card is kind of insane. But this was a fight that kind of almost made you forget that he missed weight by 0.2 pounds because it was so great. And I was almost ready to shotgun Romero right back in there. You obviously can't do it. I mean, unfortunately, there is – obvious contenders there with Gaslam and Chris Weidman to take that place, and there is a bit of an oversaturation to get a guy in there for a third straight time having lost two in a row. But God, each time Whittaker and Romero have been in the cage, they've been close fights, or they've been fight of the nights at the very least. And I'm looking forward to the time these two guys fight again. This was just a phenomenal performance by Robert Whittaker, and just the biggest bummer is the hand injury, because that's going to put him on the shelf for a while. I know he's looking to get back in 2018, but Robert Whittaker showcased his talent level, and it's just a shame because you would think how much greater this guy would have been had he not spent so much time over the years on the shelves recuperating from various injuries and illnesses. But he's already obviously one of the top middleweights in company history. Not the top, tippity top quite yet, but wins like this are going to validate that.
Yeah, I mean, we got this question from Scott basically asking what we thought was going to be next. Would it be, Whittaker Romero 3 or Whittaker versus either Kelvin Gastelum and Chris Weidman, which that question's ultimately going to come up in the buy or sell segment. So we'll leave that a little later on in the podcast to give you our answer in terms of that one. But as I said, it's just a great matchup. In terms of Dana White and what he wants with the weigh-ins, I mean, I think the question has got to be is fighter safety has to be the number one priority. And why, I think the question that Dana White would be is, why do you believe from a fighter safety aspect that having the weigh-ins at 4 o'clock is what's best for fighters? I think that's the ultimate question. And I haven't heard Dana White say anything of why it is. And just sitting there going, well, fighters are not morning people. That's not a reason why the weigh-ins should not be at 9 o'clock in the morning. And I said on last week's podcast, and when it comes to this story, how about Dana White show up at the ABC meeting and have a discussion with it, with, the medical people, with the Association of Boxing Commission and all of the, executive directors and come to a conclusion. But I think that also fighters need to be involved in this situation. I think when you look at one of the issues in MMA is there's a lot of things that's just forced onto fighters. How great would it be is if there was something where the UFC fighters and the UFC sat down and came up with a conclusion. Otherwise, I think at the end of the day, it's just Dana White's going to want to do what Dana White's going to want to do. But I have not heard anything at this point from a fighter safety aspect on why 4 p.m. weigh-ins are what's best.
Yeah, now if I was just going to push back on that, I would say I agree with you. This isn't better from a fighter safety standpoint. It's more that second prong of we want this to be safe for fighters, but also we want the weigh-ins to actually – we want weigh-ins that are safe for the other fighter in that you have less guys missing weight. And it appears as though less guys miss weight at the 4 p.m. weigh-ins – than the early weigh-ins. So that is the one pushback I would give on maybe it is a good idea to cut away the early weigh-ins. But obviously, from a fighter safety standpoint, giving them that much more time to rehydrate is clearly the early weigh-ins are above and beyond better. And when you do have fighters vocally saying, we want this to stay or we don't want to go back to how it was, you got to listen to them because that to me is – one of the utmost priority you have to have as a promoter to win this PR battle, because that is what it is. You know, it's a public relations battle, and it's one of those things where it becomes a major talking point, a major discussion point, and it can maybe distract from the awesome pay-per-view you just had if your quote dominates the news feed instead of maybe talking about the main event.
You know, and I tweet about this after the fact. You know, the main event, it's not a controversial decision. It's just a close fight. You know, if you had a 48-47 for Yoel Romero, I've got no issues with that. If you have 48-47 for Robert Whittaker or if you have it like myself, a 47-47 draw. But the other day, we saw a great fight. And when you sit down and you watch fights, whether, you know, you're on your couch, you're at a bar, or you're in a tent at the fight, that's all we want. And it was a great fight. Co-main event, Colby Covington, hey, give this kid credit. He backed up what he said. I loved his game plan, you know, coming right in RDA's face, really never, for the most part, really gave RDA any opportunity. I did see some people score this fight for Rafael Dos Anjos. I thought it was, you know, clear that Colby Covington won this fight. 48-47, I think, is pretty much the right scorecard. But give Colby the credit. You know, this kid went in there and backed it up. I didn't see it come, you know, happening. I thought we saw, a different striker this time than the last time that we saw him. But, you know, unfortunately for Colby Covington, no one really is talking about his fight once, you know, his actions inside the octagon. It's his actions outside the octagon.
Yeah, it was a deal where it may not have even been something that he had coming. Obviously, we're talking about the deal with him and Michael Bisping in the post-fight UFC show, which, don't get me wrong, I guess he did have it coming. He was throwing some shade, but man, Michael Bisping was ready to strap on some gloves and give Colby Covington a second fight. This was a verbal sparring match, and that was a 10-A round for Michael Bisping. And that's a bit of a bummer for Colby Covington just because, look, heading into this car, man, both of us picked Rafael Dos Anjos. And for good reason. There were major question marks regarding the stand-up of Colby. And those question marks weren't answered, I thought, with an A+, but a solid B+, in that his stand-up has improved. But obviously, the bread here for Colby Covington was his insane tenacity pushing. Control play, even if he wasn't able to get takedowns, he bullied RDA against the cage, and that is the type of attitude and skills that he can take against anyone in the division. And this guy may actually be champion one day when he takes on the actual champion. But yeah, this was a Colby Covington experience to 1,000, because you obviously have the solid performance that helps him elevate his stock, and then afterwards he gets himself in some controversy where he doesn't look too great.
I mean, look, it's Colby finds himself in this situation, and, you know, and look, I understand where someone says, you know, Bisping should not have handled that, the situation. I understand that, especially when, I mean, look, let's call the UFC post-fight show on FS1 what it really is. It's state-run TV for the UFC. Everyone knows it. But at the end of the day, when you tune on a post-fight show after a UFC event, you want to feel like you're getting the true opinion of the analyst. And, you know, no question that Michael Bisping, was not holding back. I mean, if you're Colby, you kind of understand, you know, hey, this guy's taking my shine. But look, if you're going to try to trash talk Michael Bisping, he's going to fire it right back at you. I mean, how great would it have been if somehow Tyron Woodley would have been on that post-fight show. Who knows what's going to happen? You know, I said last week, if Colby Covington won this fight, this is probably the best thing to happen to Tyron Woodley. I mean, I think this is a fight that could easily headline a pay-per-view. And, you know, I expect that's going to happen. You know, I think a lot of it probably depends on when, you know, Tyron Woodley is ready to go. But, you know, it's kind of like, here's the one thing about Tyron Woodley that I feel like people tend to forget. Do people forget the fact of how active he has been over the last year as champion?
I think maybe, and that's likely due to the fact that Colby Covington has constantly had the microphone in front of his face, Jason, and he just constantly spews BS. I mean, that's kind of the issue for Colby Covington, in that the interaction with Michael Bisping shined a light on kind of his flaw, in that he doesn't really have a quick wit about him, and there isn't a whole lot of logic of what he says. But what he does say is he intentionally goes out of the way to cultivate attention by saying controversial things. It's a very 2018 approach to promoting himself. And by constantly talking about how Tyron Woodley's always on the sidelines, maybe that's influenced the perception of Woodley. I think it's an absolute joke that this fight was for an interim championship. I think obviously Colby Covington has asserted himself as the top contender for Woodley's title. But it's like the most Colby Covington thing that this is, that he is now a quote unquote champion with that interim title belt. And I don't know. I thought I land on the side in terms of that Bisping Covington deal, where I side kind of with Michael Bisping in that, for the love of God, this is the first time in a very long time that that UFC post fight show was trending on Twitter. I mean, controversy yeah. creates attention. That clip had over 200,000 views on the single tweet that Fox Sports One or whatever uploaded. So the proof is in the pudding. I mean, you can follow all the journalism ethics you want to, but what's that going to get you? C-SPAN 3? I think that was a very entertaining television. And Colby Covington, I mean, this dude's a full-fledged UFC fighter. He shouldn't be coddled when he wants to make being good on the mic a part of his reputation. He's got to deliver. He went in the arena with Bisping, and obviously he wasn't prepared. But the very best guys on the mic, they can deliver when they're not prepared, and Colby couldn't. And with that still being said, Jason, there is still something marketable about that. It's not the sexiest thing in the world. He's not the sexiest bad guy in the world. It's obviously manufactured, but people still kind of hate him. And if they hate him, they still care. They don't care as much as they cared about Chael. They don't care as much as they cared about Bisping or Connor. But I will say there are enough people to care where Woodley versus Covington may do decent on pay-per-view. Not great, but decent.
Yeah, I mean, because you know Colby's gonna sell that fight. That clip of Colby Covington on the post-fight show on the UFC on Fox YouTube channel has 230,000 views. The knockout by Curtis Blaydes has 265,000 views. What do you think is the number one video from Saturday night?
I mean, it has to involve something from CM Punk.
Oh, yeah, CM Punk, Mike Jackson, fight recap. 359,000 views.
Wow, what was the fight recap? Did they show anything good from CM Punk? I mean, hey, that first round, he looked okay in that first round, Jason. He got that takedown.
As I was watching that fight, I think what would frustrate you, and I remember me and my buddies were having this conversation during the second round, was like, you know, I feel like Mike Jackson could have won that fight by stoppage in the second round. And it just, you know, I don't know what he was thinking. Like, are you just trying to get your 15 minutes of fame? Because I feel like if he would have got a stoppage, he might have at least gotten a fight maybe on the Contender Series. But, you know, obviously, I don't blame Dana White for not wanting to be in the Mike Jackson business. Obviously, they're not going to be in the CM Punk business anymore either. CM Punk, you know, he can take a shot. You know, we saw that from Mike Jackson. And, you know, look, you give any person credit that steps into a ring or cage and is going to have a fist fight, because flat out, that's something I would not do. While I sit here and make money off talking about the fight game, it's not something I'm going to do, you know, but it's just – at the end of the day, what was CM Punk versus Mike Jackson? It was low level MMA. You know, it's something that you would expect to see at a regional, a local show you go to, not a UFC show. You know, we had a question that was basically, and I think it was sarcasm coming from this person that sent it in, that it was basically along the lines of, hey, should I get a refund, since I paid $65 to watch CM Punk? And it was Troy tweeting, as someone who paid $64.99 to watch CM Punk fight, am I entitled to a refund? I hope that's sarcasm. Because, you know, look, if you pay just to watch CM Punk fight, you had to know what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah. It's like, there's already been a fight. A CM Punk fight has already taken place. You should be aware that potentially this would be the product, and you aren't entitled to a refund, but by God, this was a bad product. This first fight on the card. I mean, it got ugly. It really did. It got uncomfortable in that second round when Mike Jackson was just peppering CM Punk from his guard. And it was a really rough product. And it's one where this fight was so bad that clearly, even if he wants to fight again, CM Punk does not get another UFC fight, because they handpicked a guy who he should have beaten. And man, he made Mike Jackson look like a world beater, which is just, you know, all the respect to Mike Jackson. He ain't a world beater. That clip of Dana White tearing into Mike Jackson probably rivals the viewership of some of those clips you mentioned. I think the UFC was just looking for a way to justify not bringing Mike Jackson back. And as soon as they saw his performance in the second round, they're using that as an opening to justify it, honestly. Because obviously this fight was made as CM Punk is the A, B, C, D, and E fighter in this matchup, and he certainly failed. Look, credit to CM Punk, whatever. I mean, this dude pursued his goal or whatever, but, like, I will say this much. The one thing CM Punk has shown is, like, working hard isn't enough. Your body has to be at the right spot. It can't be too banged up. You can't be too old. And there is a learning curve, and you need to be an athlete. I mean, look at the surely Greg Hardy has been training in MMA less time than CM Punk has. I could be wrong there. And we'll talk about Greg Hardy in a little bit. But Greg Hardy looked abundantly better than CM Punk did. And from all the stories of CM Punk, this guy really, really locked in and trained hard for a long time. And it's just sad that a guy who trained for a couple years now in one of the top camps in the world put out a performance like this. But I promise you this much, if I trained for two straight years, Jason, I wouldn't perform much better. I would be quite bad.
Here's my problem with what Dana White said after the fight, where he was talking about how bad of a fight this was. He's like, well, we should have put it on UFC Fight Pass. And I'm like, do you realize what you're saying here, Dana? Are you basically telling people that you put bad fights on Fight Pass, but we want you to pay $9.99 a month for it?
Yeah, I saw that too. That was really short-sighted to downplay Fight Pass. I mean, that sentence obviously, I mean, we all know it. We all know it, but to be the guy that's like the voice of the company, to be like, we're going to push this all the way down to the lowest part of the card and the least meaningful of Fight Pass, is like, oh, that's insane. That really is, especially because like CM Punk was like the third draw on this pay-per-view. Honestly, he may have been the biggest one, which is kind of scary. It really is, and it's kind of just the state of the UFC. But yeah, I mean, Dana White, the one thing about him is he is not a genius when it comes to long-term thinking with some of what he says in interviews and sound bites. Because I totally caught what you said there, and it devalued the Fight Pass. And I tell you what, though, this was a really awesome Fight Pass card. I mean, this is probably the best Fight Pass prelim we will ever get on the platform, with Benavidez, Pettis, Oliveira, Guida, and a pair of awesome finishes with Anthony Smith and Dan Ike.
Yeah, you know, when you look at those Fight Pass prelims, you know, sad to see, you know, what happened with Rashad Evans. And, you have to imagine, especially when you looked at that Instagram post he put out initially after his fight was over, you have to think that, retirement is in his future. Of course, Dana White said that was kind of what he was thinking. You know, Joseph Benavidez, I just thought he looked slow, you know, against Sergio Pérez, and give Sergio the credit there. The 30-27 card, I didn't see the score, you know, that being 30-27, thought it was 29-28. And when I initially watched the fight, I did have it for Joseph Benavidez, but just very, very close there. Charles Oliveira, submission win. Dan Ige, nice, TKO win there. But you look at Anthony Smith, it's the guy that no longer cutting weight to get down to 185, just a beautifully timed knee, and definitely a guy that I'm interested in kind of seeing what he can do at 205 pounds.
Yeah, I think you can't tell a lot out of this performance because it was just one strike that flattened Rashad Evans, and I think this was a nice platform for Anthony Smith. I'm looking forward again to what he's going to do. And the one thing about him is that this was a perfect opportunity for him moving to a different weight class. I mean, I think every up-and-coming light heavyweight or any guy making a transition would jump at the chance to take on Rashad Evans because they caught him at the right point. This is a guy with a name that clearly needs to be retired, and it's sad to say it, but by God, this was a really, really bad performance out of Rashad Evans. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Joseph Benavidez moving forward. I mean, this guy should be the interim flyweight champion. Like, I know we have a defending flyweight champion, but Joseph Benavidez deserves some type of championship. I don't know what type of championship it is. I don't know if it's the runner-up or the number two guy in the division, but this guy's been so consistently number two for so long that it's almost like it's a passing of the torch that he finally loses to a fighter that isn't a champion in Sergio Pettis. And I thought this was a great fight, a really great fight, maybe a bit of a change in the guard. You mentioned he looks slower, and I kind of concur what you're seeing. So there's a lot of pressure for Benavidez in his next performance. And really, it was back to back to back of older guys losing with Clay Guida too, looking a step slow and getting caught in that guillotine choke. But for Joseph Benavidez, I mean, a guy who's a veteran, Jason, you would think he would learn. I mean, we've heard if you walk out to Lose Yourself or you walk out to Stan or any other Eminem song, you're going to lose. And this dude went in the cage with an Eminem haircut, and he fell to the Eminem curse.
Feel like I'm back in 1998. Speaking of that flyweight division, is it wrong of me to just not really, really like the booking of DJ and Cejudo too? It doesn't get me excited.
Yeah, I understand. Really, there's no flyweight fight that would get me excited at this point, though. I will say that. I mean, I want to see Dillashaw versus DJ. I want to see Garbrandt versus DJ. I want to see this super fight. And, I mean, you talk about cleaning out a division. Demetrius Johnson has done that and then some. I mean, I agree with you, though. As good as Cejudo has looked, there's just no interest, honestly, for any guy in that top 15 contending with DJ. I guess Sergio Pettis, but even then, not so much. I mean, this guy's really put himself in a spot where he's legitimately, like, if he just decided to retire tomorrow and we're doing pound for pound best fighters of all time, Demetrius Johnson has a very interesting mm-hmm. case.
Yeah, I mean, I think DJ versus Sergio, I think maybe why you'd have a little interest in that one just because it's a fresh matchup. But when they announced DJ versus Cejudo, I was like, oh, okay. I mean, you know, DJ's a great fighter, but that's just a fight that doesn't get me excited. And I feel like I am in the majority in that feeling.
Well, the thing is, what's crazy about and why Sergio Pettis certainly needs to get a title shot is that when you look at that top eight or top seven of contenders, it's just him and Formiga that haven't actually fought for the title yet against Demetrius Johnson. Just two of the top seven contenders.
That's crazy.
And so I think you just got to look for fresh matchups. And it's something where I agree with you, Jason. To me, it's just a showcase for Demetrius Johnson. Even though Cejudo looks great, it's just that their last fight, man, that was a clear-cut victory for the champ. And when you already have the idea of him moving up in weight up there and you don't get the best-case scenario, it's a lot like – oh, man, what was my example going to be? I don't know what my example. Maybe Ronda Rousey Cyborg would have been my example, where any fight that wasn't Ronda Rousey Cyborg, I was disappointed in from a Cyborg standpoint. And yeah, that's kind of the same point for Demetrius Johnson, is any fight that isn't him versus the Bantamweight champion, kind of a disappointment.
Yeah, no, it is a disappointment. Someone who did not disappoint on Saturday night, Curtis Blaydes, but a brutal finish there in the third round over Alistair Overeem. On Tuesday, Curtis Blaydes' manager, Ricky Guerrero, tweeting that Curtis sprained his ankle and knee in the fight, saying he can walk. He's done this before, knows it'll be 4 to 8 weeks before he's 100%. He can fight November on. That being said, he's being brought in for fight week. He will be cage side for UFC 226, and he has stated he will call out the Cormier-Stipe Miocic winner. Blaydes is right there. There's no question about it. You know, we'll have to see what happens with Cormier and Miocic. I saw someone mention about Volkov and Blaydes, and I'm like, oh, that would be an awful matchup for Alexander Volkov. But a very impressive win from him there. Coming to the rest of the card, Holly Holm, decisive win over Megan Anderson. Tala Tuivasa, a very close fight, a win against Andrei Arlovsky. Claudia Gadelha gets a split decision win. Miroslav Bektik, split decision win. And Cristal Rocha, Rashad Coulter was a really fun fight when it was on the feed. And then Rashad Coulter had no answer for when Cristal Rocha took him to the ground.
Yeah, that was your stereotypical heavyweight fight, was it not, Jason? Back and forth, sloppy as hell, and I had a smile on my face when it was over. I mean, it wasn't a technical showcase. I mean, Tuivasa Arlovsky wasn't necessarily a technical showcase either, but there was certainly greater technique there. And then even more improved technique in that Curtis Blaydes third round. I mean, Jesus, you do not want that guy on top of you. He's going to make your face look like look like the worst. You know, just like a Golden Corral plate after a couple servings. I think it's kind of crazy. Cain Velasquez obviously isn't a part of the top 15 right now for the UFC's rankings. But like, obviously on Monday or Tuesday or Wednesday, whenever the rankings come out, I'm not super sure. You're talking about the top four guys in the heavyweight division. Champion Stipe Miocic, 1, Francis Ngannou, 2, Curtis Blaydes, 3, Alexander Volkov. This heavyweight division has a very new face, and it has got a new blood very quickly. And I guess that shouldn't have been that big of a surprise given how old this division is. But as we talk now, Ngannou, Volkov, Blaydes, those are the top contenders for the heavyweight championship. And it's very interesting to see how quickly that's happened. A fight that kind of got – I mean, and by the way, Holly Holm's performance against Megan Anderson really interesting that Holly Holm really showcased how well-rounded she was. She utilized her to wrestling to win that fight. And obviously when you think of her, she was brought in as the big-time boxer. But this is a really complete fighter and, probably the second-best featherweight in the women's division, which I don't know what that means exactly, but I think she is it. Man, Claudia Gadelha, Carla Esparza is a fight that I don't think we talked about enough in the pre-fight talk up, just because like a few years ago this would have been the marquee fight in this division. It really would have, and this one delivered. It was really close. You could make a case that Esparza won. I did score it for Claudia Gadelha, but it was a great fight, really enjoyable, and I just wanted to give that a little bit of love.
Yeah, that was a very good fight, and we'll see what happens at 115. Of course, no UFC event this weekend, but they do have an event next weekend down in Singapore. UFC Fight Night, Cerrone versus Edwards, is going to kick off at 4:30 a.m. Eastern Time, 1:30 a.m. Pacific Time on June the 23rd, and your main card will start at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, 5 a.m. Pacific time, and typically Daniel, I'm an early riser until we get between around 6 o'clock. So I'm that Saturday morning, as I start kind of my work day of doing various marketing things, I'll pop the fights on UFC Fight Pass. But unless I can't sleep, there is no way I am getting up at 4:30 in the morning to watch these fights live.
I think we should do a post fight show as soon as it's over. I think we need to watch all these fights. Is there anything other than the main event of that card that sticks out to you? Other than the top two fights, I screwed up because there's a pretty big drop off after the top two.
I mean, we do, you know, we do talk about our love for Taruto Ishihara, which the UFC has clearly gotten the news that he's got to be the feature prelim. Outside of that, is it, I mean, kind of crazy that Jake Matthews is on the early prelims. He's the fourth fight of the night. But yeah, I mean, outside of the main event, co-main event, there's, you know, nothing that's drawing me to like, oh man, I have to be in front of my computer on that Saturday morning.
God, they're really taking care. And he's taking on a guy who's 2-1 in the UFC in Shinzo Anzai. That's a really weird fight to be buried on the prelims. I mean, Jake Matthews has back-to-back wins. Granted, I tell you what, Bojan Vlahovic is a pretty talented fighter, and he also has a win over Li Jingling. That's a really weird fight, and good call there. But yeah, I'm interested to see. I guess the environment is like the third most interesting thing. Obviously, Taruto's pretty interesting. I'll watch this on delay, and surely – usually these cards tend to deliver with interesting finishes or good fights. So maybe there will be something that we don't see today that in a couple weeks will really deliver. But probably not. Probably not.
I was watching Sean O'Malley on Joe Rogan's podcast, and he was talking about how initially he was slated to go over to Singapore as a guest fighter, and then the UFC said, "No, we can't allow that to happen because apparently in Singapore they can just magically drug test anyone on the street, and marijuana is zero tolerance."
What would happen? You just go to jail?
Yeah, you go to jail. Yeah. Apparently, after your third offense, it's like 5 years in jail, and plus you get caned.
Oh, my God. That's crazy.
I would say this. If you're not a big Sean O'Malley guy or whatnot, I would watch his appearance on Joe Rogan. It was just very kind of interesting, kind of just hearing the story, you know, of – I mean, look, and it's probably like a three-hour podcast, but it was very interesting to just hear him talk about kind of – you know, really how he became who he is and the fighter he is today. But when he mentioned about that, about Singapore, I was like, because I'll tell you this, I would be willing to bet you, man, I hate to put a number on this, at least 3/4 of UFC probably smokes pot.
Yeah. That's a lot. That's like a lot of people that smoke pot. I mean, don't get me wrong. Most people my age till, you know, 35, smoke pot, and then like everyone who's like famous.
Oh, I would say 45 and under.
Yeah, 45 and under is a good call. Basically, like whenever Dazed and Confused came out, that time period, like if you were out in high school when that time period was set, I think anyone who came, who was born like anyone who was in high school by 1993 and upwards, probably like 75% chance you got pot somewhere. So 75% is a lot, though, man. That's a lot of people that smoke pot. I definitely don't. Police officer listening to this podcast. So, I can't get over the fact that they came people in Singapore. I mean, I believe it. Like, a lot of countries do some weird stuff, dude. But can you imagine, like, the dude that's in charge of caning? Like, what – and, like – what
you know
if
that's
you don't,
a bad dude. You know that's a bad dude.
You know it's a bad – well, what if, like, he's sick and you have, like, the substitute caner and he just takes it – like, he doesn't know how to cane someone and it's, like, a soft cane, you know? Then it's not even a punishment. Then you just got lucky that you got a guy that doesn't know how to cane you properly, which is obviously a good thing because I think we agree, like, people probably shouldn't be caned. But, you know, just a lot to think about.
Yeah, I mean,
hopefully no one gets arrested.
Look, I mean, marijuana was, you know – I don't know if taboo is the right word, but it's much more socially acceptable now than it ever was. I mean, if you walk down the street and you saw someone, you know, smoking pot and living, I live in Florida where medical marijuana is legal. I'm not sure what it is in Texas where you're at, Daniel, but to me, at this point, it's just socially acceptable.
I'm pretty confident medical marijuana is not legal in Texas. I'm like super confident because we are super hardline towards stuff like that. But I'm sure if you're in Austin, somehow you get – I don't know. I don't really know how medical cannabis works. But it's going to change like crazy. And it's like it's kind of insane whenever you have sporting leagues that still test for it. And obviously there's a wink-wink agreement with some of the testing threshold, like it's really, really high. Like you've got to be super high while you get tested to fail these tests, probably, I would assume. But yeah, good call and good foresight because if there wasn't quality control, maybe Sean O'Malley would be in a Singapore jail in a few weeks, because I'm glad somebody caught him on that.
Yeah, especially when he's involved with a marijuana company. But that is next week. Before we get into the interviews, we do want to talk a little bit about PFL 1 that took place last Thursday. Of course, a lot of talk, I think, more from the media than anything else about this event. I did watch the show. Had a charity event to go to before this event started. We got home a little, right before the main card started up, and look, from a viewer aspect, you could definitely tell that there was a higher production value. But once the fight started, it was kind of like, okay, it's a new name, but this is the World Series of Fighting. And Daniel pointed this out to me before we started recording. I did not realize this, that Andre Harrison was a 45-1 favorite in the main event.
Yeah, and that's insane to me. I can't believe we didn't mention that on the pre-fight show. The odds must have changed big time.
I'm looking on Best Fight Odds. So at on fight day at 12:15, he was -600.
Wow, that's insane.
When it starts to get to, like, 15-1, do you really, what's the point of putting money on him at that point?
I know. Well, dude, something must have happened there, because in a fight card that doesn't get that much attention, for the line change to be that dramatic, we got some craziness. I mean, look, if you got that at 600, that ain't too bad, because as we saw in the main event, Andre Harrison was just at a completely different level than his opponent. And this wasn't the most entertaining main event. I thought the rest of the card was quite good. This wasn't the most boring Andre Harrison fight you'll ever see. I only saw the main card, which I kind of regret, because there's some important stuff on the prelims. The guy I predicted to win this tournament, Nazarino Maligari, went home with 3 points there. But I kind of like the scoring system of this tournament. I will say that much, in that you get, 6 for a first-round finish, 5 points for a second-round, 4 for a third-round, and 3 for a decision victory. I think it's pretty interesting. It rewards guys like Alex Nicholson with his phenomenal flying knee knockout, or Lance Palmer for his submission over Magomedov. But the four fights I saw, the broadcast, it was a solid broadcast, a solid night of MMA, nothing special. But a solid night. It could have been much worse, is what I'll say, in terms of the product, and it definitely wasn't.
I'm gonna admit this. Turn the Andre Harrison fight off after the second round. I just kind of was like, well, I know what's gonna happen here. It's gonna, he's gonna walk away with decision victory. Turn it off, and I went to bed. I'm not gonna act like I watched the entire fight. I turned it off. I thought on MMA Twitter there would be much more activity, and there wasn't, which was kind of surprising to me. And then when I learned the fact of that the fight card only got 116,000 viewers, when I found that information, my response was, ouch. Now, I had people in the MMA industry text me, and they used a lot harsher words. Let's just say that, that's a terrible debut in terms of television ratings. The PFL's got a really nice lineup of rosters. We'll talk about PFL 2 in the buy sell segment, but man, that is a disappointing number.
Yeah, it's a rough number. It really is. We set an over under, and it was an under this week, and it's unfortunate. I think what it tells you is, look, there isn't this thirst for more mixed martial arts. There just isn't. People who are fans of MMA don't think, you know what, I need more product than UFC and Bellator. So there isn't that demand. So for PFL, I mean, they have got to do something to demand attention, and I don't know what that strategy is. Obviously, the strategy of a tournament format is fine from a sporting perspective, but if they want to be relevant, if they want to get the type of viewers to justify a second season, you've got to really be meticulous with what you do, or you just got to hope you get lucky with a fight on your program that generates buzz. That is less likely to happen than ever before, just because there's so much content going on all the time. But if it does happen, it will happen. But they've got to really rework their thought process here, just because even though the product is good, it's rewarding if you're a mixed martial arts fan. They've got to do something significant to generate those eyeballs on their product. And the viewership they got on their debut show, and usually I think there's a bigger peak for the first show promotion runs, and then it drops off a little bit, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So that's kind of scary moving forward. But they gotta come to grips with that. This was a very bad number. They have a solid product, but they got to figure out how to get that number up.
You know, we were talking about this a little before we recorded in another matter, but if I was the PFL and instead of maybe advertising on MMA websites, I would put all of that money into advertising on Barstool Sports.
Yeah, they should just get it in bed with Barstool Sports just because they know how to get eyeballs on things. I mean, they get eyeballs on anything. They could have two guys playing beer pong and that probably get 250,000 viewers on Facebook. I mean, those guys are geniuses. Yeah. But that's the type of audience you want to market towards. Maybe have fighter profiles on those websites or have them get involved in certain types of videos. But just get these guys over in the mainstream is what I think you want to do with your Lance Palmers, your Andre Harrisons, Will Brooks, Ramsey Needhams, etc.
Yeah, I mean, look, any fighter that's based in New York, just sit there and have them do the little pizza, the pizza thing that the head of Barstool does. I mean, you know, it's just when I hear like, you know, promotions buying advertising on like MMA websites, I'm like, why? Because you know that content's going to be there regardless.
That's a great point, yeah. It's something where that people are more interested to click on the articles anyway, so it's more effective advertising. And if you have a budget, you want to convert people who are likely to watch your product who aren't already consuming information about it. So I totally agree with what you're saying, Jason, and that's our professional advice to PFL. Yeah, advertise the Barstool Sports.
Yeah, but I mean, when you look at this fight card, you know, Lance Palmer really sticks out to you. We talked a little bit about that last week. I mean, you have to imagine that if you're PFL, you know, when you're thinking about mapping out 145, you have to think that the roadmap is to potentially put yourself into a situation where your final at 145 pounds is Harrison and Palmer.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know me, I'm all part Nazarino Malagari hype train, Jason, so I think he's going to crash your parade. Maybe the decisions, or just because he's going to get 3 points time and again, but look, he's likely going to win all of his fights, and that'll be enough to qualify for the playoffs. So I think it's obviously trending that way.
I was thinking about that. I wonder when we get done with the regular season, will there be someone who won both of their regular season fights by decision that doesn't make the playoffs? I got to think that's impossible.
We're talking 4 fighters in the playoffs?
Eight fighters.
8 fighters in the playoffs. That's impossible, I think, right? I think that's mathematically. I don't know how this works, Jason. But look, it's as simple as this. Andre Harrison, if he gets 6 points, like any guy who gets a finish and a win gets in over him, obviously. So there's that. And then any guy who gets a first round finish already has 6 points. I would assume if there's a tiebreaker of 6 and 6 and one guy has 2 wins and one guy only has 1 with a first round finish, the guy with 2 wins probably gets in. But honestly, half the field, I'm pretty sure if you get 2 decision wins, you're in. But what I do wonder is what happens, Jason, if – can you get in if you only fight once? Like if you get 6 points in a first-round finish and then like you get hurt for your second fight but you're still part of the top 8, do you advance to the playoffs?
You're asking the wrong person.
Yeah, we aren't PFL experts. I was figuring out some stuff about the PFL as I was watching and I felt kind of stupid. But yeah, you know, I do wonder – who watched all these fights, because like they all mattered, you know, before and after. They had one fight after. They had Jack May and Josh Copeland go on afterwards back on Facebook Watch, and Jack May won that one. But yeah, just notable guys that won, like Steven Seiler, Malagari, Jared Rochot won a decision. Apparently One scorecard was 30-25, and another one was 29-28. I've never seen a variation in scorecards that wide where one dude went 29-28 and the other 30-25. So there's that. And then Kelvin Tiller got a first-round knockout. So there's that.
Yeah, and then, of course, they had their issues with the weigh-ins with some of the New York laws, particularly at heavyweight, about how there can't be a huge size difference between the two. Sean Jordan coming in at 275 pounds, but I guess Dana White would probably just blame that on the early weigh-ins. But I'm looking forward to PFL 2 coming up next week, and we'll have a question about PFL 2 during our buy-sell segment, which is coming up here in a little bit. But first up, we're going to get to the interviews. You're going to hear my conversations with Alima McFarlane and Jeremy Davis. Of course, McFarlane going to be defending the Bellator women's flyweight title here at the end of the month at Bellator 201. And Jeremy Davis, guy we've had on the program before, as he is going to be headlining Battleground MMA on Saturday night in Largo. So here's my conversations with Alima McFarlane and Jeremy Davis. Alima, really appreciate the time. Of course, you got this fight coming up here at the end of the month, and you know, one of the things we always hear in the fight game is pressure. What do you consider pressure?
Pressure by my family to get married and have kids. That's pressure, right? That's pressure for this fight. I would say, honestly, pressure to like kind of run through her. A lot of people don't think that she has anything to offer, and so they expect me to win. And that's like probably the furthest thing from reality. Every opponent is a legitimate threat. And especially Lada, she is stylistically a very, very interesting matchup and very legitimate threat to me losing the belt.
Why do you think that people just believe that she doesn't have much of a shot in this fight?
I think just because they've never really heard of her. She just had one fight for Bellator, and I believe it was on the prelims. So I think it's mainly from, I wouldn't say ignorance, just, you know, not really hearing her name before.
Anyone who follows you on social media, they would have seen the picture that you posted of the billboard that was up for this event, you know, and you know, obviously being the main event, you know, there's a lot of things that go into it. But for you, is it just simply, it's just another fight? It doesn't matter whether I'm the first fight or the last fight of the night?
As far as like me being nervous, no, it's just another fight. I'm nervous before all my fights, you know, but the fact that it's a main card, I don't think it adds any added pressure. I think if anything, it just makes me more excited. You know, the location of the fight, it's in where I live. It's San Diego. My entire family is going to be there from Hawaii because it's on the West Coast. So it's easy for them to travel to, and you know, everybody from my gym, my team, they're going to be there. So I think if anything, it just adds more excitement rather than pressure.
One of the things that I've heard from fighters who are champions, they'll say, I don't feel like I'm the champion until I defend the belt. Do you have that feeling, or is the mindset, you know, I won the vacant title, so, you know, this is just normal?
It kind of goes back and forth for me, but I agree, like, you're not really a champion until you defend it. But at the same time, I was the first, and I think that that's something that nobody can ever take away from me, is that I'm the inaugural champion. And so I do feel like the champion in that regard, but probably like 50% of me does agree that I do need to defend it once to really solidify myself.
I know we've talked in the past about where you are as, you know, in the 125-pound division, but do you feel that people give you the respect that you deserve as, if not the best, one of the best 125-pound fighters?
Oh, I do. I do feel that way. You know, especially because, you know, the UFC, which is Bellator's biggest competitor, basically. Their champion, Nico Montano, was kind of like me in the sense that we were kind of unknowns. We kind of came up out of nowhere. And so I think that has definitely helped show how deep the 125 roster goes. And that, yeah, like you can, you have girls like me and Nico rising up from the ranks, you know, not being, not even being in the sport for that long and being able to accomplish what we have. So yeah, I've always felt like I've got the respect that I deserve.
I know you were doing answering fan questions on the Bellator Instagram, and I saw that you talked about your greatest fight being the Rebecca Roof fight. Why do you feel that way?
So that fight, on paper, I was supposed to lose that fight. And under the circumstances of fight week, I should have lost that fight. So that was my first fight on a main card. So it was my first televised fight. It was on arguably the biggest card that they've ever put on, ever, Dynamite 2. The week of the fight was crazy. Like, when we got to Missouri, my head coach, who was also the one that got me into MMA, and he's been with me every step of the way, been to every single one of my fights in my corner, he had to get checked into the ER as soon as we landed in St. Louis. And so he was pretty much on his deathbed during fight week. Like, I had gone and seen him before the fight, and I was, like, really nervous because he looked like shit. He's also sitting right here in the pool. he looked really bad. And we were actually all very nervous that this could really be it for him. And so I was freaking out, stressing out before the fight. You know, this is the first fight that he wasn't there for. There's, like, other personal problems I was dealing with. Like, I had just broken up with my boyfriend the morning of the fight. Like, it was just all crazy. And so, and then on top of that, I was the underdog going into the fight. Everybody thought Rebecca was going to maul me. So yeah, physically, and then while we were in the fight, she was physically the strongest human that I've ever fought. She was incredibly strong, and that made me really nervous. So after that first round, I was just like, oh my gosh, I don't know if I can do this for another two rounds. And so when I did get the finish in the second round, when I was able to actually finish her and choke her out, it was just a huge flood of emotions and relief. And that was probably my most memorable moment of my career. So that's why I always say that was my greatest fight ever. Like, nothing can, even winning the belt kind of like can't really compare it to the emotions that I felt at the Rebecca Roof fight. And, you know, just thinking that my coach was going to die. Like, when the cameras were on me, I was like, this is for you, Bonello. Like, he's in the hospital right now. And yeah, that was pretty crazy.
Was there ever a point during that week, because of what was happening with your coach and the personal side of this, that you maybe thought about not fighting?
No, I didn't. I did, however, sustain an injury about like a month before the fight that we did consider pulling out. But I was like, when it started healing and got a little better, then it was good enough to fight. It wasn't 100%, but we're like, all right, whatever, so we're still going to fight. So I think it was like, all right, we already got this far. We're not going to let a dying coach stop us now. But he's okay now. He's totally made a full recovery. But yeah, there wasn't any point when we thought that, yeah, we should pull out.
Of course, we all know you as the Eliminator, but what is the origin of the Pineapple Princess come from?
You know, I don't even know. I'm trying to think how it happened. I think just because I had some pineapple. I think my pineapple sweat. So I have a pair of pineapple sweats that I would wear everywhere. And then for my first fight with Bellator, I weighed in with a bathing suit. So the pink bathing suit that had pineapples on it. And I think somebody on social media just said Pineapple Princess, and it kind of just stuck. And it became like my moniker from then on. And I really like it though. It's cool. Like we call it the Pineapple Palace. If you come to my house, there's just pineapples everywhere. And yeah, I think it's really cool. A lot of people associate me with pineapples now.
So when Bellator makes a bobblehead for you, because I noticed on your social media you said that's a next goal for you, is to get a bobblehead. Does a pineapple have to be involved in the bobblehead?
You know, it doesn't necessarily, but I think it'd be really cute. But I do know that there has to be a flower in the bobblehead, because the flower is kind of my trademark, you know? I've weighed in with a flower at every single fight, so... It definitely has to be a flower. If they want to throw a pineapple in there, that'll be cool too. No complaints.
Is there a reason why you always make sure you have a flower on during the weigh-ins?
Yeah, it's you know, it's a tradition from Hawaii. My mom and sisters also wore flowers in their hair every day. My mom was a flight attendant for Aloha Airlines, and she was known for always having flowers in her hair. So I think it's just a little piece of me that I take with me from Hawaii and can represent Hawaii with it. It's just, even though it's just something as simple as a flower, you know, people can kind of recognize it as like, oh, she must be local.
Final thing, got to ask you, do you have a prediction on how you retain your title in this matchup?
I think it's either going to come by way of submission in the first round, or it's going to go to the judges all five rounds.
And we look forward to seeing that matchup. Aleem, as always, I appreciate time and good luck here at the end of the month.
All right, thank you, Jason.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man that I've had a chance to get to know over the past couple of years, a local fighter where I'm from here in the Tampa Bay area. Jeremy Davis is going to be headlining Battleground MMA coming up on Saturday night in Largo, Florida, just a town outside of Tampa. Jeremy, man, I appreciate the time. You know, we've talked so much about the business side of you as a fighter and headlining event. And, you know, so I think naturally people say, oh, Jeremy's got pressure. What do you define as pressure?
I don't really see no pressure, really. I see this as another opportunity for me. It's another stepping stone in my career. It's what I love to do, man. As you know, most of my fights, you know, I go into these fights just to have fun, ready to rock and roll. And if I'm headlining a card or co-main event, or any, you know, top name on the card, I just go out there and have fun and put on the best performance I can.
And Carlos Espinoza, the opponent, we were joking before we started recording this, is you've kind of been in this natural, like the opponent change, but has it? Espinoza, local guy, trains out of the Spartan gym up there by Raymond James Stadium. You know, how familiar were you with Carlos before Battleground came to you with this fight?
I've seen him just a few times. You know, I've just heard his name. I think I was at an RFC event, the last one they had or whatnot, at the Olicar. I saw him fight Donnie Bush. I guess he just fought with Battleground, the last event that they had, and won. So, you know, I heard his name, didn't think nothing of it, and then all of a sudden, boom, here his name came on the contract, and I was like, no, all right, I just heard about this guy about a month ago, and let's put on a show.
You know, when you and your team put that tape in, what stuck out to you about him?
Watching him is it's odd. I've never seen a fighter do some of the things that he does. You know, I don't know if it's the training or whatnot. Just some of the things that he does I've never seen before. So, you know, I had some training partners just kind of mock what he would do just a little bit. But, you know, as I've told you numerous of times, I don't get too caught up into my opponent. I need to focus on myself and make sure that I have, you know, everything ready to go on Saturday night.
And I've seen the fact of you've kind of been going around to different gyms locally, but, you know, obviously, you know, part of this fight card, the guys around you, you know, from your coaching staff, you know, Martin Brown, who's on this card as well. I mean, when you're training alongside a guy that's fighting the same night, I mean, there's so many pros to that, but what is the biggest pro to, you know, being in that grind with someone who's competing on the same night as you?
Man, this card is very packed with Tampa's finest talent, I believe. And it's been told that, you know, with having Coach Trey also Smash Brown on the card, and then Dave Mendel, Avery, and then training with them alongside me, it's the energy's just, it's, I think we're all just right now, you've noticed the last week, so now I think that we're just ready to weigh in, and then Saturday night our locker room's just gonna be on fire and just ready to go, because it's we're all ready to go, and I know they're ready to showcase their skill.
Is the hardest part of Saturday for you the just waiting?
It is, actually. You know, it's like just sitting there letting time tick, but man, it goes by so fast. It does. It truly does. I feel like Saturday will go by and we'll be on to Sunday, Father's Day, and everybody will be back to their 9-to-5 job on Monday.
I know you've wrote about this on social media, about what this means to you, fighting the night before Father's Day. Do you think that it's going to be emotional for you?
A little bit. You know, I lost my dad in 2013 to a heart attack, and I've always carried him with me. You know, he's always been like kind of like, besides my mom being my motivator, I use him as energy. And it's because his energy when I was playing football was, man, he was that drunk that was in the crowd, and he was going bananas, man. When we go to Bucks games, he was always, you know, going. When Coach Dungy was there, he's always on him and stuff. And it was just, his energy is just something special to me. And yeah, I'll probably be a little emotional waking up Saturday, just knowing that, you know, tomorrow's that day. But I know Saturday night he'll be with me every step of the way.
Now, we're talking here on Sunday evening, and I got to bring up this Facebook post you had today where you said, "So during this weight cut, I have watched every food channel or Netflix, and I'm watching one now. So the question is, what is true pizza? Definitely not Domino's." When I saw this, I was like, oh, I hope Jeremy doesn't look at my social media as I had some ribs and wings earlier.
Kill me, man. It's I don't know what it is, man. Every weight cut, I'm always on food channels. I've been followed on Instagram by 4 different like food pages, and it's because I like their stuff, man. Like Jupiter Donuts, they just opened up in Largo, and then there's one in Palm Harbor. Jason, when I tell you these donuts, man, they look so good. And you know, pizza. You know what fighter don't like pizza? So I was watching this Ugly Deliciousness. It's caught on Netflix, and this guy travels the world checking out food, and pizza popped up, and Domino's came up as one of the worst pizzas to basically eat. So it's all about the dough, from what I was told in this documentary here.
I was watching something the other day. They're like, oh, pizza's one of the healthiest things you need. I'm like, what? I go, I don't know what you're talking about.
I wish.
not the kind of pizza that I'm ingesting, but yeah, no, it's you know, you mentioned about the weight cut, you know, and there's such a huge topic right now, particularly in the UFC with you know, the kind of the culture of weight cutting. You know, should the weigh-ins be at 9 a.m. or 4 p.m.? For you, from your perspective, just as a fighter, and I've been around you when you're sitting around waiting for that, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock for the commission to get there. For you, would you prefer the morning weigh-in as opposed to the afternoon weigh-in?
I love a morning weigh-in because I feel that, for instance, Thursday night, you know, I'll stop eating and drinking around 6. I have my own portable sauna that I can sit in and basically get whatever I need out before bed, pass out. If I check my weight Friday morning and need a pound off, I can do that. And I'd be able to head the weigh-ins if they were at 12 or 1. That 4 o'clock is just, you're sitting there all day long, and then, you know, you got to beat traffic, got to wait on the commission, and it's just a long process, and then you have less time to obviously fully hydrate. But if you do it properly and, you know, putting the right supplements back in you, eating the right things, getting back in the fluids, you shouldn't have a problem. But, you know, it's been a big topic right now, and guys are missing weight left and right.
What do you think is the biggest fighter topic right now in MMA? I mean, I think from the media side, we look at weight cutting as the biggest issue. Do you think that's the biggest issue right now?
I don't. I'm seeing a lot of, to be honest, a lot of coaches and guys are molesting their younger students. And that's some of the stuff I'm seeing. Yeah, the weight cut's the thing, but I'm seeing guys in Miami that are coaches that are, you know, with their students and stuff. And, you know, here we had one, and it seems like it's an ongoing thing. And man, that to me has to stop. The weight cut, forget the weight cut. You got coaches doing dirt with their students behind closed doors and just almost ruining the MMA name, because kids in that younger age, I feel, come to this because one, they're bullied in school, or two, they need some after school activities, and we won't have that if this continues.
As you have gone through your career, have you noticed the age of the person coming into the gym is getting younger and younger, and kind of how this sport's evolving?
Oh, absolutely. Coach Bailey over at Gracie Clearwater, I believe, has an after school program, And man, he has some of them kids look pretty young, and they're in there, and they take it very serious. And that's awesome to see the growth of the sport over the years. Of, you know, I've been in it for 7 years, and you know, obviously it's been going on for centuries. And just to see these little kids have so much drive to continue this, it's pretty impressive. And I look, you know, I have to, you know, applaud them just for getting on the mat.
When I say 8 months since your last fight, does it feel like it's been longer than that?
It does. It feels like a long time. It truly does. And I was just with my girlfriend the other day. We were watching my last fight, and it was just like, man, that was in November. And it's just like, man, it's time to get in this cage and showcase what I've been working on.
And obviously, a win here would be, you know, obviously, if you take the next step in your career. Have you started to kind of map out what you want the rest of this year to be?
I've sat down with Coach Jihad and Coach Bailey, and basically we have this fight, hopefully one more, and hopefully we get the call. You know, if it's not directly straight to the UFC, we can possibly try the Contender Series, because that's starting back up this week. And, you know, just play it by ear. But I've just been really focused on, you know, one step at a time, and you know, I'll be 30 this year. So I really just want to make sure that my body's, you know, ready for all this, and we continue to make weight and see where we go.
Do you think that, you know, previously maybe you tried to look ahead too much, and maybe as you've grown older, you've just realized, like, man, I can't be worried about that?
You nailed it right down the head. I was worried about it so much. Like, I need to get in the UFC. I need to get there. But man, I have holes in my game. You know, I have to fix those. I can't go in the UFC and just say, hey, I'm in the UFC, get beat, and they kick me out 5 days later. What are you going to call me, a UFC vet? No, I wouldn't take that title. Same if I went and fought for Bellator and got kicked out 3 days later. I'm not a Bellator vet, you know? So I was looking at it way too much and just not focused on one fight at a time, one training camp at a time. And that's what I'm doing this camp, and I'm ready just to have fun.
Is it tough to publicly admit, like, hey, I know I have holes in my game?
It's not, because I feel we all do. Everything, the sport grows, and, you know, there's all types of, you know, mixed martial arts that are just changing up the way they fight. And that's what I've wanted to do. I don't want to be just that stand up brawler no more. I want to just go out there and have fun, be flashy if I can. You know, I've had so many submissions, but let's see something else. You know, and that's what Coach Jihad and Coach Bailey said. They said, let's see something else. Let's see a knockout. You know, and so, okay, let's work on more power. Let's work on getting the hips right. Let's work on kicks. Let's work on my Muay Thai and clinch work. So, you know, I've just been putting it all together and just ready to showcase what I've been working on and continue to become a better mixed martial artist.
Now, for anyone who's going to be in attendance on Saturday night in Largo, if you want to know who Coach Jihad is, he's going to be the guy that's going to be the best dressed cornerman you've probably ever seen.
Oh, yeah, he's going to be best dressed, because now he doesn't just have me to corner. He has Coach Trey to corner, who's going to be dressed to impress. So it's a toss-up right now who's best dressed in the house on Saturday night.
How do you guys work that out on fight night? Obviously, you both need attention, so how's that going to kind of work?
Never done it before, so this is a first. I was nervous at first. I'm not going to lie to you. I was like, oh, man, like, he has to focus on Coach Trey, and he has to focus on me, but he's been doing this for years, so, you know, he knows what he's doing. So, you know, I trust the man, and, you know, I have Coach Bailey back in my corner, so we're just ready to put it all together and showcase Saturday night.
Of course, I look forward to seeing this fight come up on Saturday night. Jeremy, as always, I appreciate time. Of course, let everyone know where they can follow you out on social media.
Yeah, you guys follow me on Instagram at Pretty Boy Davis MMA 145. That's probably the best way to follow everything that goes on. Also, my fan page at Jeremy Pretty Boy Davis on Facebook, Twitter, JBeastMMA 145. But man, it's always a pleasure being with Jason on his show, man. It's a pleasure always talking to you, and you do so much for me, man. So I truly appreciate you, all my sponsors, my beautiful mom, my girlfriend. You guys have been great this whole camp, and we're ready to rock and roll Saturday night, June 16th, for Battleground MMA, baby.
And Daniel, there was my conversations with Alima McFarlane and Jeremy Davis. Interesting story there from Alima McFarlane explaining why she considers her fight against Rebecca Ruth the toughest fight of her career, talking about her coach when they thought was on his deathbed in a Missouri hospital. And then, of course, mentioning that she broke up, her and her boyfriend broke up on the day of her fight. And then Jeremy Davis, a guy that I've had a chance to get to know over the past couple of years. You know, I talk about the business of a regional fighter. Jeremy Davis is a guy, he sells a lot of tickets, does very well for himself. He's going to be in the main event of Battleground MMA here in Largo, Florida, which is part of the Tampa Bay region. I'm going to try to make it out to those fights on Saturday night. So I appreciate both those fighters coming on this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast. But right now, we are going to get into our buy-sell segment. Of course, every time this week on the podcast, we take on five MMA topics, and we buy or sell with them. And let's start off with item number one. UFC 225 will mark the final time we see Rashad Evans compete in MMA competition.
I buy this, and I didn't think I was, but I am, because this was worse than I expected. I thought a guy like Rashad Evans, win or lose, is going to be back, because obviously he's got 2 feet in the door. Obviously never rule out a retirement, but by God, this was really, really bad. This was the absolute worst case scenario. So even though this breaks my golden rule, which is never say a guy's going to retire because they always come back in the sport, Jason, I'm buying the fact that I thought we just saw Rashad Evans' last UFC fight.
I'm going to buy it as well. And I think my primary reason for buying is that Rashad Evans, when you look at what he's done as a studio analyst for the UFC, I think there's something there for him. If he were going to fight again, I got to think it's against Rampage Jackson and Bellator.
Damn. Yeesh. I think you're probably booked a Bellator main event in 2019, which, you know, those guys have chemistry together. Those guys can sell some fights. I don't know what they can do in 2018, 2019, but look, if Rashad's done with the UFC, if Dana forces him to retire and he can go elsewhere, that is a fight that's somewhat interesting to the casual fan, because the casual fan probably isn't aware that he got Lee Lawson under a minute.
Yeah, but when you look at kind of, you know, the Instagram post Rashad Evans put out there, makes you think he's going to retire. And you know, when you look at the run he's been on, and especially, you know, with what happened against Anthony Smith, I hope it is a career for Rashad. And you know, there's, you know, for me, in terms of the moment I think I'll never forget with Rashad, and is when he knocked out Chuck Liddell.
Yeah, that's a great moment for sure. And that was a moment they kind of validated him. I thought, as obviously a premier light heavyweight, the fight that I thought also where he just looked like a million bucks was the fight against Forrest Griffin right after that, when he won the UFC light heavyweight championship, because I thought he absolutely just, you know, Forrest Griffin was my guy growing up. That was my guy, and just a great light heavyweight. And I was so happy when he was champion, and I was heartbroken to see him get demolished the way he did. So with the benefit of hindsight, I must say that Rashad Evans' victory over Forrest Griffin was quite amazing, as well as, you know, solid knee to the body to Tito Ortiz that finished him off. But, I mean, what else jumps to you when you look back at Rashad's career, Jason?
You know, he, I mean, I mentioned the Chuck Liddell fight. You mentioned the Forrest Griffin fight. You know, I think one of the things that we talk about, missed opportunities, could a prime Rashad beat Anderson?
I don't think so, but that would have been an awesome fight to watch, to have seen him move down to middleweight and take on Anderson. I really don't think he would have beaten Anderson Silva, but, that is a missed opportunity. And man, even going back in the memory bank, that knockout he had over Sean Salmon, which, I mean, we're talking about Sean Salmon. This dude main evented that fight with Rashad Evans. Awesome head kick knockout. I think when you look at the very end of his career and you've got five consecutive losses, it's really depressing to think he may fight again. But if he doesn't, this dude had a phenomenal career. I think that Evans Rampage fight, man, that really felt like a big fight at the time. And that wasn't even a light heavyweight championship fight. Man, had I not been looking at this, I would have thought that was for the light heavyweight title. But it was not. He got knocked out by Liotta shortly after winning the title from Forrest, whenever that 205-pound strap was a hot potato.
Yeah. Number two, Kevin Gastelum and Chris Weidman fight for the interim title before Robert Whittaker's next title defense. I am straight up buying this one.
Oh, God, I feel bad, but I'm going to sell it. I mean, you know the UFC loves interim titles, Jason. I mean, that's why you're smart. But I just feel like Whittaker's next fight will be against one of these two guys, because I think the hand injury recovery time will be quicker than we think. But I'm probably totally wrong, and you're probably totally right, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at, even if Robert Whittaker was ready to go 4 months from now, it's a debate of whether, I don't think it should be Romero, because I think there's got to be a penalty for missing weight for back-to-back title fights. But when you look at Kelvin Gastelum and Chris Weidman, it's kind of a toss-up. I mean, yes, Chris does have the win over Kelvin, but, Chris has had the injuries, and Kelvin's been active, and Kelvin's been winning fights. I think it would be a very tough decision if he had to go between one or the other if Whittaker was ready to go, but... to me, we've got interim title fight coming here soon. Number three, CM Punk ends up fighting in Bellator.
God, that's depressing. I'm going to sell it, Jason. I really am. I know it's going to be hard for Bellator to pass up. Look, I think CM Punk wants to win a fight. I mean, if I train that hard, I would want to go in a cage and have my hand raised. I mean, this is a guy with a never-quit attitude. But, God, you're not going to get a much easier fight than Mike Jackson. So I'm going to sell this. Do you think we see CM Punk in a Bellator cage, Jason?
No, I don't. I think if he was 0-0, I think, Bellator probably would have some interest. I mean, look, it's going to cost a lot of money to bring him in. But I just can't see Bellator going down that route. I think if you really look at, we're going to see, Jake Hager, a.k.a. Jack Swagger, at some point. But I don't see an 0-2 CM Punk being something Scott Coker would go down that route. I just don't see it.
Yeah, I agree with you. But man, if you're the PFL and you're getting 100,000 viewers, you may want to slide some money CM Punk's way to get him on your card.
Yeah, if you're paying out $10 million, what's another million?
Yeah. I mean, look, man, you might as well sell your pride if you're getting viewership like that and put the guy on there. Because the thing is, with CM Punk, you do lose the MMA hipsters. I mean, they're flabbergasted, and for good reason. But if people watch, people watch, and there's value in that. Yeah.
Number four, the best fight on next week's PFL 2 card is Samino Rama versus Brandon Halsley.
Interesting. Are you buying or selling this?
I'm going to buy it. I think that it's my best fight, but there's a lot of other fights on this card, man, that are really good. Firmino Brooks in the main event, Magomedov and Jason Hayes on this fight card. What's the other one I was looking at? Thiago Tavares, Robert Whatley, but I'm going to buy this one as Samino Rama, Brandon Halsley is the best fight.
I see what you're saying, man. I mean, look, the PFL has turned into like in the year 2015, at the World Series of Fighting, and Bellator ran an all-star card. What would it look like? That's kind of what it's looking like. Halsey and Rama's a pretty good combination, but you mentioned it. Magomedov versus Jason High is my favorite fight, so I'm selling the topic here just because, like, it's crazy, man. Magomedov went straight up. He went 5-1 in the UFC. 5-1. Coming off a victory over Bobby Green. Now he's in the PFL. Just a great signing. I mean, this Jason High Magomedov fight will look just completely fine on a UFC card. It may not be the greatest thing in the world. Neither guy is known for being a fight of the night contender. But Magomedov, Jason High, I'm definitely looking forward to that. And I'm obviously interested in the Kayla Harrison fight. That's nowhere near the best fight. But I am interested to see how she performs.
I'd say, I'm a stat guy, and you bring up Bobby Green. You should look at Bobby Green's Tapology page to see how many fights he's just have fallen through for him, in terms of supposed to fight at UFC 225, pulled out due to injury, 222. had to pull out due to an injury, pulled out of the fight against Josh Berkman due to, you know, personal reasons in 2016. I mean, you just look at his time in the UFC, the amount of fights that he's had booked that ultimately just did not happen. Well, it's a crazy number.
He must have been on the Affliction Trilogy card that got canceled too. I guarantee you, if he has that bad luck, because I know he was booked on the second fight card. So if it's his luck, he was probably booked on the third show where Affliction, the entire promotion, got canceled.
Yeah, it's just, you know, I saw someone mention that on social media when he pulled out of UFC 225, and just a crazy amount of fights that ultimately have not happened for him for various reasons. Our final buy-sell is on Greg Hardy, who did get a UFC contract on Tuesday night, even though it does sound like, you know, maybe his next fight won't be in the UFC, maybe, you know, a development deal, which pretty much means LFA. But here's the question. Greg Hardy makes his official UFC debut. I initially wrote down 12 months. Let's go in the next 6 months, because I think that makes it a little more interesting.
I'm buying it. I'm buying it, man. That sucks. Like, that really sucks. I think it's a bad move by the UFC. Like, screw – like, Greg Hardy really sucks. Like, by God, this guy was not apologetic when he got called out on it. He hasn't shown any remorse for what he did. He's – God, I mean, I'm so like, don't get me wrong. We were watching this fight, and as it was happening, it was an exciting moment to watch him score that knockout, Jason. He obviously has an abundance of talent, but there's just some things where you can afford not to make this ethical compromise, and that's what this is. And I feel dirty for saying it, but looking at the way social media is abuzz now, looking at the fact they handed him a contract, he may get one fight in the LFA again professionally. But within 6 months, Jason, I think Greg Hardy has a fight in the UFC.
Tell you, man, 6 months, I think that's a tough number. I'm going to sell it because I think it's probably more in that 8 to 9 months range. You know, I think that his management, I think this is where you have to be smart with Greg Hardy. And, you know, we were talking about this before, and you can't help but wonder this question. Would Greg Hardy been given this opportunity if Lorenzo Fertitta was still the owner of the UFC? Because to me, this giving him this opportunity is nothing more about getting views and people talking about the UFC. And just
I've got a really bad question. I mean, this question is messed up. Would Greg Hardy have gotten this opportunity had he not had the domestic violence deal?
Damn,
like, you know what I'm saying? He became a name. He was obviously a very talented defensive player. But, dude, ain't no one telling you who's the 15th best pass rusher in the NFL.
No, I mean, I think the problem that you have here with the UFC is there is no true policy they have on domestic violence. They say they have one, but look, ultimately, and we both know this, this is about how much money you can make the organization and how many eyeballs you're going to put on the product. I don't like Greg Hardy being put in this situation. I've said on this podcast, I really question American Top Team for bringing him in. You know, someone who, you know, all you got to do is Google his name and you know exactly what happened. We don't have to sit here and tell you, you know, what allegedly happened. I don't understand why the UFC did this. You know, and look, and you know, next month there's probably going to be, you know, there's going to be people who are going to, you know, probably have that question about Nick Newell. And, you know, Dana White talked about it after UFC 225, and there was a reporter who, I'm not sure if he was a, you know, like a newspaper reporter or maybe he wasn't an MMA reporter, that was basically, you know, talking about Nick Newell, you know, talk about how it's a high, you know, high risk, high reward type situation. And, you know, look, and we've talked about this podcast, if Nick Newell had two full arms, he'd be in the UFC.
100%.
You know, and I don't know if a win on the Contender Series gets Nick Newell in the UFC.
Yeah, I think he will though. I think it does though. It's just because.
And look, I think Nick Newell could beat a lot of guys in the UFC.
Yeah, but it's always about that worst case scenario that scares you away. Obviously.
Exactly.
It's him getting demolished on TV. I think you go for it. I don't think that's going to be a worse PR hit than putting a dude like Greg Hardy, who is kind of synonymous with domestic violence, right? Like, when you think about, to me, he was, I mean, yeah, Ray Rice was the big one, but Greg Hardy was definitely number two when it comes to thinking about domestic violence in athletes during that period when it seemed like, Jesus, there was a story so often. So I would tell you this, as bad as the visual is of a guy with one arm losing a fight in brutal fashion, I think the UFC is going to get much more negative feedback for employing Greg Hardy, which they're probably going to do. And once again, I just don't think they should do it. This was a promotion. I mean, it's one thing if you get in business with Floyd Mayweather, who, like, that's big business. I mean, that is that – it kind of – it's real sick at its core. It really is sick. But it's not comparable, that type of money versus the type of money Greg Hardy will bring you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess – you know, we've had this conversation about Nick Newell and how much, you know, probably him getting into the UFC is ultimately a TV question. But you have to wonder, does Fox or, you know, ESPN in 2019 want to have a Greg Hardy MMA fight due to his past?
Yeah, I don't think ESPN would. I really don't.
But I mean, but if you're at UFC, don't you? I guess you probably just put Greg Hardy on pay-per-view.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have to worry about your TV partner getting up in arms. It's going to be I don't agree with what they're doing, but it's going to be very interesting. And I will say he is someone that does generate eyeballs, which is a shame. But that's obviously why they're in the Greg Hardy business, which is a bad business to be into. Well, and I just don't want to hear that the whole like, oh, he's turned his life around. Deal. Like, come on, let's not turn him into let's not glorify Greg Hardy at the very least.
Here's a question. Were there more people watching the Contender Series on Tuesday night than there was watching PFL 1?
That's a good question. I would say no, honestly. I don't know if 114,000 people were tuning in live.
Well, I mean, we both know this. That Greg Hardy knockout is going to be on every sports website.
Yeah. When it's all said and done, obviously more people are going to consume that information. But if you're just asking me straight up, do I think 114,000 people watched that live? I don't think so. But obviously, this is going to be a major topic. I mean, we talk about Barstool Sports. I mean, within 10 minutes of this fight being over, there was already a blog post about it. And Greg Hardy fighting the UFC, I mean, that's likely a talking point on SportsCenter tomorrow or on Sports Nation tomorrow, potentially, especially this time of year when there's no other sports going on except baseball.
It'll be on all the – I mean, the High Noon, I started watching that show with Bonomi Jones and
Pablo Torre.
That's actually – I like – I mean, you know, I mean, look, it's just a different form of what First Take is and – Get Up is, they're all essentially the same show when you really think about it. Because, God, man, I cannot take this whole, like, I don't know. I mean, we're both big sports junkies, man. God, the LeBron free agency talk, I am just over it.
Yeah, because we've literally heard it every year since,
I was watching game 4 of the NBA Finals. I got the pregame show on. The first 10 minutes is about LeBron's free agency, and I'm like, fellas, you do realize there's still a game to be played, right?
Yeah.
I get the series is technically over, but I'm like, I'm sitting there going, oh, man. But then I'm sitting there going, man, that's a TV executive. Like, everyone wants to know about LeBron, man. Oh, God, man. Oh, man. Yeah, I will say it will be absolutely hilarious if LeBron ends up in the Lakers, Paul George ends up in the Lakers, and Lonzo Ball gets traded.
I got a better one, and I'm stealing this from someone. God, I wish I knew where I saw this on. What if he goes to Boston and he forces him to trade Kyrie Irving?
Oh, man.
That would be messed up.
Well, Kyrie's a free agent after next season.
Probably, yeah. And I think he'll resign. I think he wants to be the guy for a city. He wants to be the guy in Boston. And, man, very few very few cities in basketball better to be the guy than Boston. So I think they're going to give him the Supermax or whatever, and he'll stay. But you know, he's got to stay healthy.
You know what's crazy? When you think about the biggest NBA markets, L.A., Chicago, New York, all three of those teams really don't have huge stars.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest star is Porzingis.
Yeah.
Knicks, but he obviously is a guy who's in the oven right now. He's cooking. He's not there quite yet. But you're totally right. And I mean, those are three teams that should be good. And the reason why they're where they are is, you know, malpractice by general managers that have cost them. I mean, the Lakers are on the up and up, but the way that Kobe Bryant era ended was abysmal. The Bulls were not built for the future, and they made some very bad trades. And then the Knicks, I mean, that's from the top down. I mean, James Dolan was awful, but that Phil Jackson experiment was a rough one. I mean, yeah, the one guy you can point to for all three teams is Phil Jackson, although I guess his time with the Lakers and Bulls was a bit better than his time in New York.
Also helps when you have Hall of Fame players. I think we both know that. But getting back to MMA, you know, no UFC, no Bellator this weekend, but you got some regional MMA. On Friday, you got CES 50 on Access TV. Vacant bantamweight title, Dennis Paiva versus Andrew Uel. I hope I spelled that, announced that correctly. Also, John Manley is on that card. Saturday, the ACB card. Man, this is a great lineup, Daniel. Thiago Silva versus Chris Camozzi. Luke Barnett's on this card. Brett Cooper is taking on Adam Townsend. Tanner Bowser's on this card. EJ Brooks, a guy that I'm very familiar with, on this card. Luis Palomino is also on this card. Like that ACB lineup. And then on Saturday night, you have Shamrock FC 306. That'll be on Flow Combat. Bobby Volker going to be headlining that card against Darius Flowers. But to me, when I'm looking at potentially taking in, you know, MMA this weekend outside of, you know, probably trying to go to the local event here in Largo, Florida, that ACB card really sticks out to me.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that fight between Brett Cooper and Adam Townsend. I think that's a really nice matchup, and it's going to be cool to see them run Australia. It is, and the thing with ACB is they really stack it. You know, there aren't a whole lot of fights to jump out to you like this is the greatest fight since sliced bread, but it's just stacked with guys you've heard about, guys you care about, and out of all the fight cards, that's definitely the one I will be watching if I have time.
And final thing to note here, I reported this on Tuesday, Chris Honeycutt has signed a long-term contract extension with Bellator MMA. He has not fought in 2018 yet. Of course, coming off that loss against Rafael Lovato Jr. And by the way, speaking of all of Bellator, here over the next couple weeks, we will have Bellator 201 fighters coming up next week on the podcast. We'll be joined by Valerie Letourneau and Syed Awad. So look out for that. And then the following week, we're going to have Ryan Couture and Robbie Peralta on the podcast. So plenty of Bellator 201 content coming to you here on the MMA Report podcast. But that is going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the podcast, which you hear every Wednesday morning on RadioInfluence.com.
This is an In the Trenches with Ian Beckles. Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
This whole thing with the Philadelphia Eagles and our beloved president probably is not going to go away. You've heard that POTUS uninvited the Eagles. I saw an interview with Doug Peterson, the head coach for the Philadelphia Eagles, and he's kind of disappointed, and I understand that. This, to a lot of people, this is not about politics, and I get that. It's about just being honored. It's not about politics. It doesn't matter if you're Democrat, Republican. That's what normally happens. You get invited to the White House. Now, the reason why the African-American, not just African-Americans, because, you know, Long is white, and he's definitely not going. It's not really about his views politically. It's about his views towards the NFL. You know, calling them SOBs. You know, Doug Peterson's disappointed because, I mean, that would have been great to go up there with, get a chance to see the White House in a different situation. I think that would be a pleasurable little vacation. But as an African American NFL player, you have to at this point understand why they wouldn't want to go. You have to. If you don't see it, then you're not opening your eyes.
In the Trenches with Ian Beckles can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.